If you want the real story behind the NFL, you need the Stinkin' Truth Podcast. Three-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth breaks down the biggest plays, the biggest games, and the untold stories that make this game what it is. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Recovery from addiction can take many forms, and quite often, it's a team effort. For those in recovery, having support often leads to a better outcome. And for those supporting people in recovery, they celebrate every milestone. Here's to family, friends, loved ones, healthcare providers, and community groups who are essential to helping people find their path to recovery. If you or someone you know is experiencing addiction, visit cdc.gov/stopoverdose to learn more about the various treatment options available.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
Text message. This middle screen, I think, sent this one in. I wonder if Hard Knocks covering the AFC North is going to show Deshaun Watson as the guy who's working hard to overcome adversity.
Yeah. Hey, where are we on the... Did the NFL stay mostly hands-off with Deshaun Watson last year? I guess we didn't really get a chance to see... Because the Joe Flacco, I bet Roger Goodell was subtly happy that it was Joe Flacco making that run at the end of the season.
Oh yeah,
than Deshaun Watson. They still don't quite know how to handle all the Deshaun Watson.
Well, could you have imagined though Deshaun Watson in a playoff game at NRG Stadium? What that would have been like last year? I mean that place was already off the chain. Can you imagine if it was Deshaun quarterbacking the Browns?
If he had turned in the same performance as Joe Flacco?
Yeah, two pick sixes. I'm so excited for the season, man. I can't wait for the season to get here. In no small part, because the Texans appear to be, and we'll see, you know, but like they look like they're on the way to being built to last here. Like, this is not, you know, a bunch of spending in free agency to try to catch lightning in a bottle. Like, this is a foundation thing. And to that end, Pro Football Focus did their best players born in the 2000s. Kind of a Pro Bowl, you know.
So how old are these people? Like 12, 13 years old? I can't possibly be old enough that these guys are actually in the NFL
now,
right?
They can't drink yet, can they? Yes, yeah. Yes, they can. They've been able to for a while now, Sean and Seth. Best players born in the 2000s. And the Texans get three guys on this team. It's basically like the equivalent of like a first-team All-Pro for guys born in the 2000s. And I think you could probably predict which three. The Texans are second in terms of number of players. The Lions got four guys in this thing. The Lions, man, they have done a great job of building that squad. The Texans get C.J. Stroud, Will Anderson Jr., and Derek Stingley Jr. onto this thing. And I think getting the quarterback is big, obviously, getting him on there. But, man, that Stingley played well enough in the second half of the season to now put him on the same squad as Sauce Gardner in an exercise like this, Seth.
Yeah.
When 2022 looked so bad for that sequence of picks for the Texans, you know, taking Stingley at three, misses almost the whole season, or felt like that at least.
Yeah, he played 11 games.
Yeah. And then Sauce, he played 11 games last year or his rookie year?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, this past year. He played nine games his rookie year.
Okay, so he got half the season.
Felt like the whole season.
Yeah, because he was out for the whole second half of that season. And Sauce was literally first-team All-Pro. Stingley has closed the gap a little bit on that, I think.
He's closed the gap. I saw, as an NFL player tweeted out a couple days ago that Stingley was robbed of being an All-Pro last year. He played 11 games. Yeah. You know, it wasn't like he missed the games at the end of the season. He missed all those games at the beginning of the season. And the way Derek Stingley played last year, in terms of perhaps being under-recognized or unheralded, I don't expect a guy that misses that many games to be all pro or to make do any of the other stuff. But, I mean, everything he did when he was healthy was worth getting really excited about. And then especially when they started having him track Amari Cooper all over the field, do those things that you really need your number one lockdown guy to do. And it opens up a lot of stuff for D'Amico to do. When you've got a guy like Derek Stingley, you can say, okay, yep, we'll just put this dude on their best receiver, and then we'll help everybody else out. That goes a long, long way. It's just that with Stingley, I can't enjoy it because the injuries have been a thing every single year since 2020. I mean, like, every single year. It's not just some fluke at this point. It's that these injuries have plagued him. and he works his butt off. Like, there's a point where I almost start to worry whether he's got premature J.J. Watt syndrome.
Oh.
Where he's a guy that works so hard. You know, he's out there after training camp, every day after training camp, no matter how hot it is, he's out there with some young wide receiver working on releases and hand fighting, all these other things for a good half hour out there in the heat. Like, he works and works and works. I just hope that he's figured something out in his personal preparation that keeps him healthy moving forward.
Yeah, it's, you know, when we talk about the offseason, and, you know, Nick Caserio will say on this show or when he does press conferences, yeah, we've got 30 and 40 guys that are in the building every day. Like, I'm talking like in February and March. Stingley's one of those guys. Stingley's in the building every day. He's one of those guys. I think, too, maybe the instructive thing, and this isn't, I'm not breaking any news here. This isn't a eureka moment or anything like that. But it does go to show you, like, when you get top picks, cash in on them. You know, like the Texans had three top three picks. They've had three top three picks in the last however many years, you know, because when they finished poorly before, they traded their picks away. You know, they traded a pick to Cleveland, you know, in the Deshaun Watson trade that wound up being Denzel Ward. They had traded other picks that wound up high before, and for good reason. You know, they had a nice little run there for a while. They had three top three picks. It's these three guys. It's three guys who might be all pro at their positions here in the coming years. So it's not a killer if you don't get one of those picks right. You know, it's not, I mean, look, the 49ers literally traded multiple firsts for the right to draft third, and the guy they picked is a backup quarterback for the Cowboys now. You know what I mean?
Like,
because they were so good at doing everything else. But man, the margin for error that getting Stingley, Stroud, and Will Anderson Jr. correct, like wildly correct in the top three, it gives you a little bit of cushion, you know, especially the quarterback.
You know, the Lions forever were a team that had squandered some of their top picks. And then they turned it around. Like, they didn't turn around as an organization completely, obviously, but starting with Calvin Johnson back in 2007, they ended up getting... So I guess this would be the cautionary tale. They got Calvin Johnson correct. They got Matt Stafford correct. They got Ndamukong Suh correct. They drafted those three players in the course of four drafts.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty damn good. And yet they never capitalized on that. There's a lot more you got to do right. But the Lions were the cautionary tale for, you know, in previous iterations where they had drafted a Charles Rogers, oof, a Joey Harrington. There was somebody else in there at some point. There was they'd messed up some high draft picks early on. But yeah, it's good to get those right, but then you got to fill out the rest of the roster.
You do, and they're doing a good job of that. I just think, when I think of getting the top picks right, I think of the Astros, and you know, there's a lot that went into building the Astros. I get it. You know, the Latin American pitchers that they got, guys already there in George Springer and Jose Altuve. But you know, you get that stretch of 2012 through 2015 where you're picking in the top two or three or five every year, and that yielded Carlos Correa, Alex Bregman, and Kyle Tucker. And that's a sport where that's a whole lot more fraught with guys picked that high in the draft that don't turn into anything, you know? Like,
I would say, look, for the Texans in their history, if you go over their very, very top picks, like their top three in the draft picks, you've got David Carr, not successful.
Mm-mm.
Mario Williams, I would say that was a success.
That was a good pick.
And, I mean, he didn't end up playing for your team for 10 years or what have you, but he's a career sack leader. Or, you know, up there in the career sacks.
Yeah, yeah.
Jadeveon Clowney would be the one that he was a good player. It wasn't what he lived up to in terms of expectations of being a number one overall pick. If Jadeveon Clowney had been picked 10th overall, I think he would have been viewed as a very solid pick.
Yeah.
I think he never turned into a top sack producer, but he was very, very impactful versus the run and a better pass rusher than the sack numbers would suggest. So it was just the fact that he went number one overall. They squandered that when you look at the other guys they could have taken instead of him.
For sure. And sometimes, too, you're right, Khalil Mack was four picks after him. Yeah. Sometimes, too, it's how you come in. You know, Mario Williams came in, and he was a little bit, not a mystery. I mean, people watched him play at NC State, but that was the Reggie Bush and Vince Young draft. Like, Clowney was viewed, like, people use the word generational with Clowney coming into the NFL. Like, he was, you know, he was the anointed one from the time he signed with South Carolina coming out of high school, you know?
Mario was a weird one because he got his production unconventionally. It wasn't like he routinely destroyed offensive tackles, but he was so long and so athletic that he could make a lot of plays where, you know, you'd watch how teams game plan for him, and they didn't have an issue leaving him with a tight end or, you know, sometimes a running back to block him. But that he would still, because he was so long, he would still make plays and cause fumbles and accumulate sacks, but without being like a Julius Peppers style of pass rusher.
Yeah. Someone texts in, Aaron Donald was in the Clowney draft also. He was. Yeah. He was picked 13th. Like, there's a certain number of picks that you need to be within the guy we're talking about to where I can blame the Texans for not taking so-and-so. Like, when Aaron Donald goes 12 picks after Clowney, I can't. Should the Texans have taken Aaron Donald? Sure. As should the next 10 teams that picked after the Texans. You know what I mean? Like, to me,
Aaron Donald, you know, when you look at Aaron Donald, when you go back and watch Aaron Donald's college film, he was awesome. He was incredibly good. He was not the specimen that he became. And I could see where he was shorter, which is like there's plenty of evidence. You know, there's plenty of Hall of Fame defensive tackles that are 6'2" or shorter. But I know I can see where some of the reservations were with him and going in the top 5 or the top 10 even. I don't worry about it that as much. He's not an example of the Texans and the Texans alone being idiots. And
right,
not,
right.
You're right. There's the Khalil Mack, you could have more discussion about that because there were a lot of teams that like Khalil Mack more than Mario or more than Jadeveon Clowney.
Yeah, I mean there were certain points during that process where there were mock drafts with the Texans taking Khalil Mack. You know, like that was the thing. I guess if we're to go back and look at that and rehash and say who should they have taken? I mean the three that went after Clowney, Greg Robinson, Blake Bortles, and Sammy Watkins. Like those weren't good football players. Now then you got Khalil Mack, Jake Matthews, and Mike Evans. God, the draft is so wild, man. Clowney goes number one. Clowney, good career. Good, solid career. Still playing, right? I mean, he's still playing a decade later, and he's productive. He had almost 10 sacks last year. And then three guys that bust out pretty much. Watkins had an okay career, but Mack, Matthews, and Evans are pro bowlers. You know?
I would say, though, this too, Sean, in terms of, you know, obviously don't get too far ahead of yourself because all these guys have not proven really anything in terms of being genuinely great NFL players over a duration of time. They all have to prove that over time. CJ knows that. Will knows that. Derek Stingley knows that. But the big, big, big knock against Derek Stingley was his injury history and whether he could stay healthy or not. So I think there were a lot of talent evaluators that looked at Derek Stingley, and if he had been healthy the entire time, they totally 100% would have liked him over Sauce Gardner.
Yep.
But those are a big thing. Like, and you can't ignore it. That's a known thing. These are not flukish instances with Derek Stingley because he'd been injured the two previous years and had health concerns. So I still that is still remaining out there as a big variable into whether like how we end up looking at the Derek Stingley.
Dude, I get in these wormholes when I open up these old drafts. Like Zach Martin was in that draft. Remember that was going to be the Johnny Manziel pick, and then the Cowboys select Zach Martin. And now he's a Hall of Famer.
They had to take Jerry Jones. They had to pry his finger off the nuclear button.
Yes.
He was about to go Johnny Manziel. Can you imagine how bad it would have been for Johnny Manziel in Dallas?
Oh, he's talked
with
about
all
that.
His buddies from home and college and from the underworld, like right there.
He's talked
all
about
the all the temptation. Oh, it would have been beautiful.
He's
it would have been a beautiful
it.
Disaster.
Oh, yeah. No, it would have been amazing. Brandon Cooks was in the first round of that draft. I didn't know Jimmy Ward was a first rounder back in the day. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Ward, first-round pick. Bradley Roby. Man, a lot of Texan ties in this thing. All right, I got to close this. People are not tuning in to hear me.
Really? Why don't you read a box score next, Sean?
Don't tempt me with a good time.
Yeah.
Recovery from addiction can take many forms, and quite often, it's a team effort. For those in recovery, having support often leads to a better outcome. And for those supporting people in recovery, they celebrate every milestone. Here's to family, friends, loved ones, healthcare providers, and community groups who are essential to helping people find their path to recovery. If you or someone you know is experiencing addiction, visit cdc.gov/stopoverdose to learn more about the various treatment options available.
Hey, football fans, you want the real deal? The raw, unfiltered truth about everything going down in the NFL? Join Mark Schlereth, 3-time Super Bowl champ, on the Stinkin' Truth podcast. He's breaking it all down for you.
no punches pulled. From the game-changing moments that won or lost a game to the player evaluations, this is analysis you won't hear anywhere else. Mark's got you covered. So strap in and get ready for the ride, because this isn't your average football podcast. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Charles Barkley announced his retirement earlier this week on TNT. I'm a sucker. I take people for their word. I'm like, oh, Charles Barkley. It's sad he's going to retire in a year.
He said he was retiring from television.
Yeah, let's hear exactly what he said. Here's Charles Barkley on NBA TV the other night.
You know, there's been a lot of noise around our network the last few months, and I just want to say, I've talked to all the other networks, but I ain't going nowhere other than TNT. But I have made the decision myself, no matter what happens, next year is going to be my last year on television. And I just want to say thank you to my NBA family. You guys have been great to me. My heart is full with joy and gratitude. But I'm going to pass the baton at the end of next year. I hope the NBA stays with TNT, but for me personally, I wanted you guys to hear from me, because I'm not doing any more interviews. Don't y'all be calling me. Nobody calling me. I'm not talking about this again.
Okay, there is a theory now, Seth, that Charles Barkley announced his retirement as part of an effort, like a Hail Mary, to kind of push the NBA back to TNT. For those who don't know, ESPN, the NBA is typically, they typically have multiple broadcast partners. Amazon is all locked up and ready to go once this round is up after 2025. ESPN is all locked up and ready to go. They've got room for one more, and NBC has been the leader in the clubhouse throughout this negotiation. But TNT does have, I believe, verbiage in the contract that allows them the right to match. They get the best and final. And they're in major debt right now, like $40 billion worth of debt, the company that owns TNT.
That's a lot of money. A
lot of money. So there was a theory floating around yesterday. It was Mike McCarthy of Front Office Sports pointed out appropriately that Charles has intimated retirement many times before in his life, both as a player and a broadcaster, and never follows through on it.
Oh.
Until the one time he was really forced to retire from playing because his quad ripped off the bone as a rocket in 2000, or whatever the injury was, some bad leg injury. But that this is maybe Charles, who loves TNT, loves working for Turner, trying to see if the NBA wants to voluntarily create a life in the NBA that does not include Charles Barkley. You know what I mean? Like, the NBA's like, fine, Charles ain't going to work for these other networks. That's not going to impact us. We're still signing with NBC. Does the NBA go, man, we want Charles to be a part of our coverage because he's such a great ambassador and he's so entertaining that we're willing to maybe take a little less from TNT to make sure that Charles sticks around, and they kind of call his bluff on this retirement right here?
That's smart.
Yeah.
Ooh,
it's a good chess move, right?
It's five-dimensional chess.
Yeah.
I wonder, if you look at it from the NBA's perspective too, you know, with the sports leagues, they're always trying to figure out, okay, how do we cater to our very valuable middle-aged customers, because they buy products and advertisers love the men 25 to 54. But you still also want to appeal to youth. I feel like Charles Barkley has an appeal to all age levels, because I would imagine the people, teenagers and people in their early 20s look at Barkley as like a lovable older uncle that they actually enjoy his jokes at Thanksgiving, unlike your annoying uncle that does pun after pun after pun. It makes inappropriate comments about his nieces and all that. Like, that's not who Charles Barkley is. Charles Barkley is a lovable uncle.
Yes.
And that's very valuable to sports leagues. They got to be able to cut through with multiple different age groups. Yeah, I could see that perhaps. Now, I don't know though. That also then becomes honestly, if there were a memo that said exactly, if there were a memo floating around between the NBA and TNT that said exactly that, that's probably grounds for an antitrust suit of some sort.
Yeah.
Because then you're altering prices and competition and all that. So I don't know. I feel like that might be a little too far out there.
Yeah, normally my response to that would be, I don't know. Charles just doesn't seem like somebody who wants to get involved in the negotiations to that degree. that he wants to be a chess piece to go like, hey, Charles, how about you threaten retirement and maybe that'll get the NBA back to the table with us here at TNT and they'll accept our deal. Like, Charles strikes me as someone, man, y'all just go do your own deal, you know, like that kind
of
thing.
It was just, it would be bad business by the NBA if you're going to say like, all right, we're going to screw over ESPN. We're going to give a lower price to this one, to this one entity that's not nearly as strong as the rest of you financially or in terms of, you know, non-NBA viewership. I'm skeptical of that.
I am too. But the thing that makes me argue with myself on the point I just made about Charles like just not wanting to get involved, every interview I've seen, he is very emotional about the, I'll call them the little people involved in all this, you know, the behind-the-scenes people. I mean, there's literally like 200 people behind the scenes that are part of this product that probably find another home somewhere within Turner, I would guess. But there's going to be some probably that'll be without jobs. Like, Charles is very cognizant of the working class folks in every job that he's in.
Maybe they'll split off TNT into a separate corporation.
Something.
Just spin it off into TNT basketball or something. Sell off the rest of their assets.
I tell you what, Barrett Sports Media had an article with the people that, hey, these are the people that could replace Charles if at TNT or just replace the void left behind by Charles in NBA coverage. And I read the list. And I come to the conclusion that nobody is going to replace Charles Barkley. The best name they gave out was Draymond Green, and I don't even like Draymond Green. You know, like,
yeah. Did you like Charles Barkley?
Yes, he was my favorite. Yes, he was my favorite player from the time the Sixers drafted him in '84.
It's hard in Houston sometimes to.
Charles Barkley.
There's a different history in Houston with Charles Barkley.
Mine goes back to the '80s. I was a Sixers fan. He was my favorite player, and then when the Rockets traded for him, I was over the moon. Yeah.
You know, if there's one thing I've learned, though, too, is you can't judge a guy's personality as a player and expect that that's what it's going to be as a media member. Like, Randy Moss has become one of the more popular NFL media figures, and I don't think anybody would have necessarily predicted that when he was playing.
Agreed.
There's some dark horses out there that might end up being just delightful as broadcasters.
I think Draymond would be good. I just don't think he. I don't envision him getting into Charles Barkley's neighborhood.
Replace him with Tim Duncan,
or a cardboard cutout of Tim Duncan. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Payne and Pendergast with you. Chandler Parsons, former Rocket, he was on his FanDuel show with Michelle Beadle and Sham Sharania. I didn't realize there was this drama going on right now. I knew Klay Thompson was looking like he's not going to re-sign with the Warriors. Chandler Parsons takes what is a current trend with athletes and lays it out here as if we're all now discovering that this is what athletes. I'm a little surprised that Chandler Parsons is laying this out in such a way that he thinks the audience isn't aware of this phenomenon that Klay Thompson is doing right now with the Warriors, who he unfollowed on all his social media.
As stupid as this whole topic is and how crazy social media is, and I hate it, this is definitely something. You don't just unfollow your team. You don't just accidentally do, you know, I mean, you weren't hacked. Like, this is something where if you unfollow, and again, this is so wild that we're talking about this, that this is a story, but this is the world we live in. There's something here, and I definitely think he's up to something. You don't just unfollow the Warriors and follow Paolo, the best player on the team that there's rumors that you're going to go to and get a big offer from this summer. So this is definitely interesting. You don't just do this for – and Klay Thompson doesn't just do this for clicks. Like, there's clearly some sort of animosity or anger or some sort of disconnect here where this is happening, and then deleting the pictures of him and Steph and winning the championship, like – this is almost like you're deleting your past with your ex-girlfriend and you're starting fresh and you're moving on. So as little as it is, it's pretty big.
Yeah, and he's like the 1,000th athlete to do it. You know, like, it's
I don't know. You know what? I guess maybe he's trying to make it into more of a point than it is, except that I do feel like there was a period of time where athletes would do it and you wondered. And because usually they would dismiss it as like, well, no, I have a social media manager that was just cleaning things out or whatever. Where now it has become standard practice. Yeah. I guess maybe that's where. Do you feel like he was being tone deaf to like the fact that everybody else is already in on this?
No,
that it's notable when.
No. And now that you're talking it through, maybe I should give him credit. Because sometimes in this business of broadcasting, we're told, like, hey, man, lay things out, not for your smartest listeners, but lay them out. And I don't mean intelligence-wise. I mean, like, sports
most
plugged
dialed in.
Yeah. Lay it out for the people that are in the meaty part of the curve, not the hyper invested part of the curve. So maybe that's what he's doing there.
I don't know if I mean, it's probably only 3 years ago where I started actually really taking it seriously when people were unfollowing this guy or that guy. I guess unfollowing the team account is a go-to move now.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's I just never have felt like it's a notable enough thing that's worth disenfranchising yourself from the fan base. It's one of those things that maybe there are other ways to send messages to like three specific people in the organization than to do it publicly, where we've seen this with Micah Parsons. You know, Micah Parsons, there's no need for him to publicly say, well, yeah, who knows? You know, there's a good chance I'll be gone next year, or whatever he said last year during the season. There's ways to get that message across to the front office that, hey, you mean business. Mm-hmm. But perhaps because of the world we live in, that it just feels that much more real. It's more of a shot. It's a shot across the bow.
Yeah.
That you do mean business, that I'm not going to be some schmuck, and you can't use some of these high school hairy tricks where you try to question my loyalty or something like that. But I don't ever feel like it's what I would advise my client to do if I were an agent.
No.
Let me be the bad guy. Yeah. Let me tell them that you mean business.
Yep.
And that's all we need to do. Just keep everything else just smooth sailing publicly.
He unfollowed the Warriors and followed Paolo Banchero. I feel like when it's followed up, I feel like when the unfollow has a corresponding follow where dots can be connected that you're leaving a relationship to enter another one, that's pretty next level right there. Clay
what
Thompson.
If I unfollowed you on social media?
And followed somebody.
Cause?
Right.
Yeah,
followed Granato.
Followed Colin Coward or something like that. Nick Wright was on Colin Coward's podcast the other week, and he cited something I had told him a long time ago. So he told that, you know, he gave me credit for the point he was about to make. And then Colin wrote something down after he said my name. He like looked off to the side and he wrote something down.
Oh.
I'm like, no, Nick, I don't need this. I don't want no. I don't need to go work for Colin Coward.
Oh, I could see you. Oh, you would handle that real well. Sitting on that little couch as Cowherd menaces over you like a gargoyle while he's interviewing you.
Right.
Like I'm one of his minions.
Yeah. Oh, that'll go really well. Actually, you'd be fine. I think you'd be fine.
I don't know. I don't like the format of television sports talk. I can't sit there with that serious look on my face, or then you just get completely irate about, you know, 10 years ago, maybe I would have liked it already. It's just too much. I can't be constantly fuming about some nonsensical thing. Klay Thompson is going to lead to the ruination of young athletes everywhere with his social media tactics.
Yes. Yeah. I need this. I need you 2 days a week in L.A. 2 days a week. And as long as you can still do the show, you'd have to get up at 2.
I can't multitask that enough. I like my life, man. I like my life.
You'd have to get up at 2 in the morning to do the show from L.A. I just remember back to Vegas when we were there. I was mush by the end of the week from doing the show at 4 in the morning local time out in Vegas when we were there for the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Oh, that was for the birds. Fun trip.
I thought I had a good time. The only thing I didn't like was walking through the casino at 2 a.m. stone cold sober.
Yeah,
I felt like a casino worker. I was like, there was no envy in me because at 2 a.m. in the casino, you're looking at some pretty pathetic souls at times.
I know.
And then it took when I would take a break after our show.
Yeah.
The 7 a.m. in the casino isn't much better, or whatever time it is locally there. Yeah.
Pathetic souls that
8
were playing. Pathetic souls that were playing blackjack and getting free booze. How are you not jealous of those people? I don't get it. All right.
There's some that are having a good time. There's some that are on their 25th hour of being awake and just not having a good time.
And I'm jealous of all of them. Yeah. Tristan Casas, young Boston Red Sox player, on a Father's Day night, had a great story. Red Sox playing the Yankees, I believe, and had a great story, Little League story. It's a really heartwarming story that maybe some of you have experienced with your dad and Little League back in the day.
So I'm in coach pitch, and, I'm so young. I don't really know what's going on at this point still. I'm still just playing baseball just to burn calories and get out there and get some sun.
Right.
Right. And, I head out one day, and I come back to the dugout crying, pissed, and, that's what a six-year-old does. He sits on the bench and he cries and he doesn't want to go out there when, you know, his team's playing defense. So my dad, you know, being the dad that he is, trying to teach me the lessons that he did in his own special way, came into the dugout. He actually grabbed me by my shirt, dragged me to the line, and Looney Tunes style kicked me out onto the field. And actually had one of my best friends that I went to high school with later. He ended up playing pro ball. His mom actually called child services on my dad, had him arrested at the field. No, for real. This is no joke. At the field, I see my dad go away in the cop car, gets arrested, send the nice to jail.
You're
but
kidding.
That day, my dad taught me a super valuable lesson that not a lot of people know, and it's that I had a responsibility to my teammates, I had a responsibility to my coaches, to the parents that showed up that day, all the fans who
were good, man. That's good right there. I can cut it off. All the fans. He's in coach pitch. I had a responsibility to all the fans out there of our coach pitch team. That made me chuckle.
The fans who would have my father arrested.
I don't want to bury the lead. His dad got hauled off in a cop car, but that was funny.
I'd love to hear the follow-up to all of it. Like, okay, I'm supposed some parenting classes were involved afterwards and everything. Like, I wonder if his father softened a little bit. I don't know what the display... there's no way from knowing from that situation whether the woman was in the right or not and calling the cops. I have zero clue. And people are going to take from that story what they want. I don't want to get into all of that. But I would love to hear the follow-up as far as, like, okay, what were the tactics afterwards?
The key here is, what did the Looney Tunes style kick look like? If he was just kind of dragging him by the back of his jersey out to the line and then gave him a nudge out onto the field, like, get out there, then calling CPS is probably a little over the top. But if he legit, like, wound up and gave him a kick to the butt, like, legitimately, like, kicked him, then yeah. I'm not saying I would call CPS in that case, but you're putting your welfare, you're putting the chances of you getting hauled off into the hands of way too many people if you, like, physically, if you could hear the kick, that kind of thing.
I wonder if... Looney Tunes style could mean a million different things, too. Like, did he drop a piano on his head?
Bad stuff happened on Looney Tunes, man.
Did he? If it was Looney Tunes style, what I'm thinking of is if he were Daffy Duck, the bill would be on the back of his head. So maybe, like, the bill on his cap ended up facing backwards.
And his beak would get spun around.
That's what would happen to Daffy Duck when he took a wallop.
I know. That was good stuff.
It's interesting, too, that the mother of the other child, her son would go on to be a professional baseball player. So it's not like the different the different parenting styles, like, can have different results for different kids.
Yeah, it's management styles, man. Some kids need the Looney Tunes style kick, man. Just,
I wonder if his dad's cool with that story being told. That's a pretty heavy deal, man.
Seeing your dad get taken away in a cop car?
Dad getting taken off in a cop car, from a Little League game.
Yeah.
That didn't have to be out there for the masses, you know?
It didn't, but as you know, I've been watching Sons of Anarchy. And if my dad were Jax Teller, that would probably not be the first time I watched him get taken away in a cop car. You know what I mean? Like, maybe Tristan Cassis's dad had several petty crimes along the way, and seeing him get driven off in a cop car was like watching him take an Uber somewhere.
The only time I had experience with Child Protective Services was, I think I must have been like 5 years old. And, my father was a colorful individual. There was an issue, and he wasn't abusive whatsoever or anything. It was a custody thing. He just decided not to send us back home one summer. So, I got woken up in the middle of the night and the cops were there somewhere off in, like, bum bleep North Carolina, and they took my sister, my brother, and I away from the trailer that we were living in a cop car. And I'll say this, my dad, as complicated as a person as he was, he couldn't have been a better father in that specific moment. Like, now, sure, he should have maybe sent us home to our mother when he was supposed to, but it was by legal.
Right, that would have been
by legal decree.
Sure.
But it was about, like, as he made me look at it like it was an adventure. He kind of talked to us and he wasn't arguing with the cops or anything. He kind of he understood that, like, all right, this is a messed up situation for these young kids, and he kind of gave us a pep talk about, you know, the nice police officers were going to take us to see my mom and everything.
Where did you, so did they bring you, where'd they bring you? Like, to the airport?
I think they took us to the police station.
Okay.
Where my mom and my uncle were.
Oh, okay.
Because, like, you know, my mom was, like, sitting up 1,000 miles away, kind of waiting for the kids to show up and never did. So she had to go
She flew
down
to North Carolina.
They drove down to North Carolina. We had no money for flying, Sean.
My bad.
And then we drove back up to. It was a fun adventure. My mom and my dad. Well, my dad didn't do it. My mom was really, really good about, like, no matter how many weird, crazy things my dad did, my mom fought her ass off. And I think she drank a lot of wine coolers and smoked a lot of cigarettes. She fought her ass off to not bad talk my dad in front of us.
Yeah. It's a big key in divorce, man.
Yeah. And it was my dad and his various wives were not as good at it. But like it was something as an adult, I really appreciate just how hard it must have been for my mom to do that. But yeah. She took a pretty bad situation and tried to make it better.
Yeah. That's
good. A lot of pride swallowing.
Yeah. How old were you?
I'm probably 4 or 5 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was at an age, too.
They didn't put me in cuffs or anything.
No. That would come much later. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah.
But that's good, though. That's a good tactic. Like, that's 4 and 5, like, that's the age where you're in, like, pre-K and kindergarten, and they're teaching you, like, hey, these are your friends, the firemen, the policemen, and all those things. So you're getting put in a cop car. Like, you're getting to go with your friend, the policeman, right here.
They were nice police officers,
were they?
As far as I can remember. Yeah.
Someone said,
"My sister was crying." I was like, "You're not going to last a day in the clink. You better get your crap together." I said, "I grabbed her. I said, listen, you're toughing up right now. You go in there, you beat up, you pick out the toughest SOB you can see. You find whichever 3-year-old in there needs an ass whooping.
Yeah.
And you take it to her."
Seth is the first 4-year-old to ever slip a shiv to his sister in the back seat of a cop car.
I did. I grabbed a plastic knife on the way out of the trailer and sharpened it.
You're gonna
need this. Headed to the slammer.
He's going to go in the clink. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you on a Tuesday. All right, for all of the it's early, hey, it's 162-game season, for all that chatter, the Astros are 9 games back. This is the furthest back they've been all year. If this is who they are, what are the reasons to watch the Astros when the dog days of summer really roll around in July and August? I've got a few. You can write them down in case we need them. That is coming up next.
Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Text page. My mom was a champ like yours was too, Seth. So a little fist bump from the text
page. Didn't talk any smack about her ex?
Yeah.
Your father?
Yeah.
It's tough, man. Swallowing your pride in a divorce situation.
It is. It is. Not easy. Not easy.
I would talk so much smack. You hear me, Brandy? I would talk so much smack.
Oh,
I'd start
I'm
a campaign.
Paid. I like to ramble on and tell dumb jokes.
First salvo's been fired, if we're being honest.
Yeah, I know. She's been psychologically torturing me for decades now.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so I think it's safe to say, like, I don't know, for me at least, I can deal with the people when the Astros are starting 7-19 and they're like, hey, it's early. Hey, it's 162-game season. Like, all right. I mean, that's a really bad start, but that was the start for the Astros, 7-19.
Sean.
We ain't there anymore.
I was on the radio on a station in New York yesterday, and we were laughing about how the last time I'd been on this station I was trying like hell to explain the Jack Easterby situation and everything else that went along with it as succinctly as possible. So we went through that and we were laughing about that. We talked about the Texans and the Bills. This is actually in Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. The Bills for a little while. And then after we'd been laughing about how hard it was to explain a really tough situation with the Texans to an outsider back in the day, he's like, so what's going on with the Astros? And I'm like, Seth, we got a minute left. What's going on with the Astros? And I'm like, I'm trying to think, like, should I try to name off all the injured pitchers? Where am I going to screw the slow starts to Bregman or any of the, like, what? I don't know. I don't know where to begin. I don't know where to begin.
Well, because it's not.
I just gave him a little bit of Jose Abreu talk because that was the a name they could latch on to.
Yeah, yeah, it's tough because it's not just injuries. It's not just conventional poor play. Like there is some odd mystery. I don't know if dysfunction's overstating it, but like they're like the whole construct. You know?
Yeah. Realistically, I would say if it comes to dysfunction, if this is just something that's weird or wrong. The Jose Abreu stuff, just it just reeks of something where, all right, there's decisions being made at a higher level, or there's just something that doesn't feel quite right the way they're handling all of this. The rest of it, really, at the end of the day, I think if this team wasn't a team that was coming off of four World Series appearances and seven straight ALCSs and all of that, I think that it would just look like a combination of bad luck and underperformance and curious decisions by a manager that become more glaring because of the situation.
Yeah.
A spot has been stuck between a rock and a hard place in a lot of respects with where this roster is right now and what his options are at every given point.
Yep.
And you can second guess. There's very good reason to second guess a lot of the decisions, but the sum total of it all, Espada hasn't done anything that makes me feel like, oh, if you were managing the team 2 years ago, it would, you know, they would have been a bad baseball team or they wouldn't have been as good.
Correct. I agree. So if this is who they are, and the further we get with all these weeks where they're like, oh, we went 3-3 in these two series, or we took 2 out of 3 from this team. Oh, but you went, if this is who they are, if they're a team that's a below 500 team or a hovering around 500 team, we're going to have irrelevant baseball in September for the first time in a decade. You know, like even during the bad COVID year, September was important because it comprised half the season.
Right,
you know,
right. And they were on a run.
They made the playoffs.
You know, they'd been awful in the first half of the season. The COVID season right now is our greatest hope.
Yeah.
Is it just you keep reminding yourself like, oh, okay, they underperformed. It was blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Right, right. So, but if this is who they are, if we get to September, it's like they're not 9 games back, they're 12 games back, you know, then what are the reasons to watch the Astros? I've got 4 for me. And if you want to text in 713-572-4610, Seth, I want to see what you think of these. Number one, Hunter Brown. Hunter Brown is I think the organization views him as a future foundational piece of the starting rotation. And in his last five starts have all been quality starts, and he has a sub-2 ERA. Capped off by out-dueling Skubal on Friday last night, the Cy Young favorite in the AL right now.
Yeah, and I think that it's followed a nice progression of, okay, he had a very, very slow start to the season.
Very.
I'd say if you even just make it arbitrary and go back to from the beginning of May to now, which would be 5-8 starts.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a 2.58 ERA.
Really good.
Batting average against him of 195.
Love it.
He's been a very good pitcher since the month of May rolled in.
Yep.
And the addition of a sinker to his arsenal made a huge difference. He's doing a lot of things. He's starting to show a lot of signs of just pitching like a veteran pitcher, knowing when he's got to throw strikes, knowing when he can flirt with the zone, all of these other things. I feel very good about him. So, yes, I eagerly anticipate watching Hunter Brown for the rest of the season.
I will still make time, even if the Astros are out of the race, to watch Hunter Brown starts. I will make time to watch Ronel Blanco starts to see if the clock strikes midnight. A very different case than Hunter Brown. He's in his early 30s. Hunter Brown, you know, he's in his 20s. Hunter Brown is your classic, like, okay, this is a draft pick we got right, and he's going to be a big part of our rotation. Ronel Blanco is like a $100 bill that you found between the cushions right now. Like, holy smokes. So does the clock? I will also be making time to watch Ronel Blanco starts, but looking at it through maybe a slightly different prism than Hunter Brown. Like, does at some point, is this the real Ronel Blanco, basically, is what I'm asking? Or at some point, is there a regression lurking around the corner with him?
Right, right. Yeah, I don't. I feel very confident in Ronel Blanco. I'll be, and I will be, again, partly because I feel like he speaks for my people, the heavy sweaters. I'm personally invested in him. When I see Ronel Blanco out there performing well despite losing, probably if he didn't drink enough fluids during a game, I'm guessing he'd lose at least 10 pounds in a game, maybe 15 or 20.
Yes.
It's a triumph. It's a triumph of will every time that he comes out of Minute Maid Park, which these days seems to be consistently 80 degrees.
Yeah.
No matter what.
I guess Blum was talking about that on the broadcast the other day, about how hot it is inside of Minute Maid Park.
Was he complaining?
I don't know. Somebody texted in that he was talking about it.
Apparently the policy at Minute Maid is that the way their system is set up, it has to be, they can only set it for 20 degrees cooler than whatever the outside temperature is. And given that it's 90 degrees or over just about single day anymore. I guess it's in the high 70s there more often than it's been in the past.
That's fine, but this is the first year I can remember it being an issue. You know what I mean?
I know, I haven't heard so many people complain about it before this year.
Okay, the third thing. So Hunter Brown 1, Ronel Blanco 2. These are reasons to still watch the Astros if they're out of the playoff race in, say, August. Contract triggers. If Ryan Pressly gets to 50 games, his contract, his $14 million vests for next year. He's at 29 games right now. Presley's not been good. I don't know. I think most Astro fans probably are possession arrow pointed against wanting Presley back next year.
There is with Pressly. This is the hard thing. Like, there's legitimate things and legitimate issues. He's talked about this, like, where, like, some of it is, like, he's had bad luck. Like, there have been... his batting average on balls in play is way higher than it should be given a period of time. That should swing back the other way, but he's also still partly responsible for it. I'm still looking forward to the second half of the season for Ryan Pressly.
Yeah.
I do think the luck will balance out. I think that it was probably the appropriate move at this stage in his career to move him off of closer. And I'm not going to like make excuses that he's not as good in the eighth inning as he is in the ninth. It's just that I do think that there's reasons for optimism there.
At this rate, he's going to sail past 50 games. The other one is Justin Verlander's 140 innings that if he gets to, his player option vests for next year, so he would have the option of sticking around for $35 million next year, half of which will be paid by the Mets, half by the Astros, or leaving if he wants to. I can't imagine he's not going to opt into $35 million next year.
This is where I am with that. Like, right now, as of now, he's not on pace to get that number, but that's because that includes all of his injury time early in the season. If he hits that trigger, it's going to mean that he's been pretty healthy the entire way.
Yes.
And I don't expect him to have a Jose Abreu-style fall off the cliff all of a sudden.
No.
So I think that I'm looking forward to that in as much that if he hits that trigger, then he's been pretty healthy and presumably pitching pretty well.
Last one, Breggy farewell tour, Seth. Alex Bregman farewell tour. Last couple months of the year.
If it's going to be a farewell tour, how likely are you to participate in the standing ovation in the last home game?
I would participate in it. Alex Bregman's been a really good Houston Astro, and he's been a big part of the most successful stretch that any professional sports team has had in this town. 100% I would stand and give Alex Bregman an ovation. If we knew he was leaving, that's what Carlos Correa got, right? Carlos Correa got ovations at the end there when we knew he wasn't coming back.
I think both Correa and Bregman handled it really well. You know, they haven't made divisive statements. They've talked about the business side of things, but not in such a way where it sounds like they've got an axe to grind with people or anything like that. I mean, everything would have been fine with Garrett Cole if he just hadn't had that moment at the end of their World Series departure where he just sounded bitter and was like very... Like, in a moment where every other Astros fan was also in pain, he made it very clear that he was in business for himself at that moment. Like, that was the sticking point with Garrett Cole. Everything before or since, I think that Astros fans would have just been fine with Garrett Cole because the business is the business. But it was just that one moment. So barring a moment like that, I think Bregman is still beloved.
Is watching NFL football about to get a lot easier for fans? And do we have Mike Florio to thank for this one as well? That is coming up next.
If you want the real story behind the NFL, you need the Stinkin' Truth Podcast. Three-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth breaks down the biggest plays, the biggest games, and the untold stories that make this game what it is. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In life and recovery, every day is a little different. Embrace the good days, the not so good days, and the challenges, and acknowledge how you overcame them. Find the path to recovery that works for you. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Text page. My mom was a champ like yours was too, Seth. So a little fist bump from the text
page. Didn't talk any smack about her ex?
Yeah.
Your father?
Yeah.
It's tough, man. Swallowing your pride in a divorce situation.
It is. It is. Not easy. Not easy.
I would talk so much smack. You hear me, Brandy? I would talk so much smack.
Oh, I'd start a campaign. Paid. I like Ray and Milani tell dumb jokes.
Yeah. First salvo's been fired, if we're being honest.
Yeah, I know. She's been psychologically torturing me for decades now.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Okay, so I think it's safe to say, like, I don't know, for me at least, I can deal with the people when the Astros are starting 7-19 and they're like, hey, it's early. Hey, it's 162-game season. Like, all right. I mean, that's a really bad start, but that was the start for the Astros, 7-19.
Sean.
We ain't there anymore.
I was on the radio on a station in New York yesterday, and we were laughing about how the last time I'd been on this station I was trying like hell to explain the Jack Easterby situation and everything else that went along with it as succinctly as possible. So we went through that and we were laughing about that. We talked about the Texans and the Bills. This is actually in Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. The Bills for a little while. And then after we'd been laughing about how hard it was to explain a really tough situation with the Texans to an outsider back in the day, he's like, so what's going on with the Astros? And I'm like, Seth, we got a minute left. What's going on with the Astros?
Shoot,
and I'm like, I'm trying to think, should I try to name off all the injured pitchers? Where am I going to screw the slow starts to Bregman or any of the, like, what? I don't know. I don't know where to begin.
Well, because it's not.
I just gave him a little bit of Jose Abreu talk because that was the a name they could latch on to.
Yeah, yeah, it's tough because it's not just injuries. It's not just conventional poor play. Like there is some odd mystery. I don't know if dysfunction's overstating it, but like there, like the whole construct. You know?
Yeah, realistically, I would say if it comes to dysfunction, if this is just something that's weird or wrong. The Jose Abreu stuff just reeks of something where, all right, there's decisions being made at a higher level, or there's just something that doesn't feel quite right the way they're handling all of this. The rest of it, really, at the end of the day, I think if this team wasn't a team that was coming off of four World Series appearances and seven straight ALCSs and all of that, I think that it would just look like a combination of bad luck and underperformance and curious decisions by a manager that become more glaring because of the situation.
Yeah.
A spot has been stuck between a rock and a hard place in a lot of respects with where this roster is right now and what his options are at every given point.
Yep.
And you can second guess. There's very good reason to second guess a lot of the decisions, but the sum total of it all, Espada hasn't done anything that makes me feel like, oh, if you were managing the team 2 years ago, it would, you know, they would have been a bad baseball team or they wouldn't have been as good.
Correct. I agree. So if this is who they are, and the further we get with all these weeks where they're like, oh, we went 3-3 in these two series, or we took 2 out of 3 from this team. Oh, but you went. If this is who they are, if they're a team that's a below 500 team or a hovering around 500 team, we're going to have irrelevant baseball in September for the first time in a decade. You know, like even during the bad COVID year, September was important because it comprised half the season.
Right,
you know,
right? And they were on a run.
They made the playoffs.
They'd been awful in the first half of the season. The COVID season right now is our greatest hope.
Yeah,
is it just you keep reminding yourself like, oh, okay, they underperformed. It was blah 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 blah.
Yeah. Right, right. So, but if this is who they are, if we get to September and it's like they're not 9 games back, they're 12 games back, you know, then what are the reasons to watch the Astros? I've got 4 for me. And if you want to text in 713-572-4610, Seth, I want to see what you think of these. Number one, Hunter Brown. Hunter Brown is I think the organization views him as a future foundational piece of the starting rotation. And in his last five starts have all been quality starts, and he has a sub-2 ERA. Capped off by out-dueling Skubal on Friday last night, the Cy Young favorite in the AL right now.
Yeah, and I think that it's followed a nice progression of, okay, he had a very, very slow start to the season.
Very.
I'd say if you even just make it arbitrary and go back to from the beginning of May to now, which would be 5-8 starts.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a 2.58 ERA.
Really good.
Batting average against him of 195. He's been a very good pitcher since the month of May rolled in.
Yep.
And the addition of a sinker to his arsenal made a huge difference. He's doing a lot of things. He's starting to show a lot of signs of just pitching like a veteran pitcher, knowing when he's got to throw strikes, knowing when he can flirt with the zone, all of these other things. I feel very good about him. So, yes, I eagerly anticipate watching Hunter Brown for the rest of the season.
I will still make time, even if the Astros are out of the race, to watch Hunter Brown starts. I will make time to watch Ronel Blanco starts to see if the clock strikes midnight. Very different case than Hunter Brown. He's in his early 30s. Hunter Brown, you know, he's in his 20s. Hunter Brown is your classic, like, okay, this is a draft pick we got right, and he's going to be a big part of our rotation. Ronel Blanco is like a $100 bill that you found between the cushions right now. Like, holy smokes. So does the clock? I will also be making time to watch Ronel Blanco starts, but looking at it through maybe a slightly different prism than Hunter Brown. Like, does at some point, is this the real Ronel Blanco, basically, is what I'm asking? Or at some point, is there a regression lurking around the corner with him?
Right. Yeah, I don't. I feel very confident in Ronel Blanco. I will be again, partly because I feel like he speaks for my people, the heavy sweaters. I'm personally invested in him. When I see Ronel Blanco out there performing well despite losing, probably if he didn't drink enough fluids during a game, I'm guessing he'd lose at least 10 pounds in a game, maybe 15 or 20. Yes. It's a triumph. It's a triumph of will every time that he comes out of Minute Maid Park, which these days seems to be consistently 80 degrees.
Yeah.
No matter what.
I guess Blum was talking about that on the broadcast the other day, about how hot it is inside of Minute Maid Park.
Was he complaining?
I don't know. Somebody texted in that he was talking about it.
Apparently the policy at Minute Maid is that the way their system is set up, it has to be, they can only set it for 20 degrees cooler than whatever the outside temperature is. And given that it's 90 degrees or over just about single day anymore, I guess it's in the high 70s there more often than it's been in the past.
That's fine, but this is the first year I can remember it being an issue. You know what I mean?
I know. I haven't heard so many people complain about it before this year.
Okay, the third thing. So Hunter Brown 1, Ronel Blanco 2. These are reasons to still watch the Astros if they're out of the playoff race in, say, August. Contract triggers. If Ryan Pressly gets to 50 games, his contract, his $14 million vests for next year. He's at 29 games right now. Presley's not been good. I don't know. I think most Astro fans probably are possession arrow pointed against wanting Presley back next year.
There is with Pressly. This is the hard thing. Like, there's legitimate things and legitimate issues. He's talked about this, like, where, like, some of it is, like, he's had bad luck. Like, there have been, his batting average on balls in play is way higher than it should be given a period of time. That should swing back the other way, but he's also still partly responsible for it. I'm still looking forward to the second half of the season for Ryan Pressly.
Yeah.
I do think the luck will balance out. I think that it was probably the appropriate move at this stage in his career to move him off of closer. And I'm not going to like make excuses that, oh, he's not as good in the eighth inning as he is in the ninth. It's just that I do think that there's reasons for optimism there.
At this rate, he's going to sail past 50 games. The other one is Justin Verlander's 140 innings that if he gets to, his player option vests for next year, so he would have the option of sticking around for $35 million next year, half of which will be paid by the Mets, half by the Astros, or leaving if he wants to. I can't imagine he's not going to opt into $35 million next year.
This is where I am with that. Like, right now, as of now, he's not on pace to get that number, but that's because that includes all of his injury time early in the season. If he hits that trigger, it's going to mean that he's been pretty healthy the entire way.
Yes.
And I don't expect him to have a Jose Abreu-style fall off the cliff all of a sudden.
No.
So I think that I'm looking forward to that, in as much that if he hits that trigger, then he's been pretty healthy and presumably pitching pretty well.
Last one, Breggy farewell tour, Seth. Alex Bregman farewell tour. Last couple months of the year.
If it's going to be a farewell tour, how likely are you to participate in the standing ovation in the last home game?
I would participate in it. Alex Bregman's been a really good Houston Astro, and he's been a big part of the most successful stretch that any professional sports team has had in this town. 100% I would stand and give Alex Bregman an ovation. If we knew he was leaving, similar, that's what Carlos Correa got, right? Carlos Correa got ovations at the end there when we knew he wasn't coming back.
I think both Correa and Bregman handled it really well. You know, they haven't made divisive statements. They've talked about the business side of things, but not in such a way where it sounds like they've got an axe to grind with people or anything like that. I mean, Garrett Cole, it would, everything would have been fine with Garrett Cole if he just hadn't had that moment at the end of their World Series departure where he just sounded bitter and was like very, like in a moment where every other Astros fan was also in pain, he made it very clear that he was in business for himself at that moment. Like that was the sticking point with Garrett Cole. Everything before or since, I think that Astros fans would have just been fine with Garrett Cole because the business is the business, but it was just that one moment. So barring a moment like that, yeah, I think Bregman will be still beloved.
Is watching NFL football about to get a lot easier for fans? And do we have Mike Florio to thank for this one as well? That is coming up next.
Hey, football fans, you want the real deal? The raw, unfiltered truth about everything going down in the NFL? Join Mark Schlereth, three-time Super Bowl champ, on the Stinkin' Truth podcast. He's breaking it all down for you. No punches pulled. From the game-changing moments that won or lost a game to the player evaluations, this is analysis you won't hear anywhere else. Mark's got you covered. So strap in and get ready for the ride, because this isn't your average football podcast. Follow the Stinkin' Truth in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
For those in recovery, support from friends and family often leads to better outcomes. Here's to those who are essential to helping people find their path to recovery. Visit cdc.gov/stopoverdose for information about treatment options and how to support those experiencing addiction.